search was done for me by Mrs. Comparé, whose tireless work as secretary of this program makes it possible for us to keep it going. Over a period of many years, she has filled notebooks with articles and clippings giving authoritative information on the subjects discussed on this program. And having this material at hand, instead of having to spend several days running down all the sources, has truly been a lifesaver. Besides being such a fine research assistant and secretary, Mrs. Comparé is also a speaker in her own right, having spoken before many meetings and in broadcasts over this and other radio stations. Today, Mrs. Comparé will be our speaker, and her subject is America's Christian Beginnings. Mrs. Comparé.
In a brief period of time, the United States, the mightiest nation in all history, grew out of a handful of people in a wilderness. Our military might holds back the enormous hordes of Asia that seek to enslave the world under communism. Our wealth rebuilt the lands devastated by war, even the lands of our enemies, and we have fed half the world. What power could produce this miracle? Only the fact that America was created a Christian nation with Christian ideals. Just what is Americanism? Have you ever tried to define it? For our wisdom, for our very survival, we should examine our principles. Where shall we find the definition of Americanism? Should we go to the minority groups who themselves say we're different, separate? A minority whose different ways of life and different ideals must be given separate recognition. Should we accept their definition? No, for they themselves proclaim that they have no understanding of or sympathy with Americanism. Should we listen to the brainwashed youths turned out by our schools and colleges who have had no experience of life, who know nothing but what their teachers tell them and can only parrot what they are told should be our way of life? No, for they know nothing of the subject. We must ask those who made this miracle. Americanism is not a theory evolved by liberal professors in their attempt to remake the world in their own image. It is a way of life. It cannot be merely taught or theorized. It must be lived. And no one can teach it or define it unless he has lived it. We must get our definition from those who made the American way of life. 3 centuries ago, a tiny handful of men and women faced life on a strange continent. They had no homes but what they could build with their own hands before winter came. They had but scanty food, and they didn't yet know what crops would thrive in this new climate. They faced the daily hazards of an inhospitable wilderness, peopled by cruel savages. They were not supplied by government subsidies. They received no wealth from the taxpayers of another nation. Yet, out of that same wilderness, they built the greatest nation the world has ever seen. How did they do it? What were the tools they used? The answer to that will be the definition of Americanism. Let's let them tell us. America was founded by Christian people. So earnest were they in their insistence upon pure Christianity that they left their comfortable homes, their farms, and their shops in the land of their ancestors, and crossed a broad and dangerous ocean to build in the wilderness a new civilization dedicated to Christianity. In the Mayflower Compact, they wrote the purpose of their coming in these words: having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia. America was founded on Christianity. How did they build on that foundation? Consistent with their faith, they built a Christian government. For example, most of the 13 colonies gave religious tests for public office. Delaware, by the Constitution of 1776, required every office holder to make the following declaration: I do profess faith in God the Father, and Jesus Christ his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore, and I do acknowledge the holy scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. Massachusetts required a declaration that I believe the Christian religion and have a firm persuasion of its truth. Maryland, by the Constitution of 1776, every person appointed to any office had to take an official oath of allegiance to the state and also to subscribe a declaration of belief in the Christian religion. New Hampshire required that senators and representatives should be of the Protestant religion. This remained in force until 1877. New Jersey declared that all persons professing a belief in the faith of any Protestant sect who shall deem themselves peaceably under the government as hereby established shall be capable of being elected into any office of trust or profit or being a member of either branch of the legislature. Vermont's constitution required every member of the House of Representatives to take this oath: I do believe in one God, the creator and governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good and punisher of the wicked. And I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration and own and profess the Christian religion. North Carolina, by the Constitution of 1776, provided that no person who shall deny the being of God or the divine authority, either of the Old or New Testament, shall be capable of holding any office or place of trust or profit in the civil department within this state. South Carolina provided that no person should be eligible to the Senate or House of Representatives unless he be of the Protestant religion. Virginia denied public office to anyone who denied the Christian religion to be true or the Holy Scriptures of Old and New Testament to be of divine authority. Thus they built the greatness that we have inherited from them. The first schools were founded to give Christian education to their children so that all who might come to positions of leadership would be firmly grounded in Christianity. For example, King's College, which is now Columbia, advertised, "The chief thing that is aimed at in this college is to teach and engage the children to know God in Jesus Christ and to live and serve him in all sobriety, godliness, and righteousness of life with a perfect heart and a willing mind." Amherst, Dartmouth, and Yale were established for training in the Christian faith. For the first century, 40% of Yale's graduates became ministers of the gospel. Mr. Harvard, in founding Harvard University, said this: "Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning." Horace Mann, father of the American public school system, declared, "Moral education is a primal necessity of social existence. The grand result in practical morals can never be attained without religion. And no community will ever be religious without a religious education. Had the board required me to exclude either the Bible or religious instruction from the schools, I certainly should have given them the earliest opportunity to appoint my successor. By contrast, today, many of our states prohibit reading of the Bible in our public schools. What benefit can they hope to gain by being ashamed of their God?" The following verse in the Sarah Fenton translation of the Bible seems to apply to them: "Your educated cause shame, terror, and disgrace, for they reject the word of the ever-living. And what can their education do for them?" You find this in Jeremiah 8:9. Today, the United States needs more men who realize that the independence of our nation was established by statesmen unashamed to acknowledge their dependence upon God. George Washington, in directing that Sunday church services be held for soldiers, said, "To the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian." Our nation was born in dangerous times. and could not have survived them if not founded on God's truth. As a Christian nation, we became great. Our power never weakened until our faith was weakened. The road to survival is the same one we followed to greatness. As a Christian nation, we rose, and as a Christian nation, we shall stand forever.
Now, Pastor Comparay.
To many of you, the idea that the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, and Scandinavian nations are the Israel of the Bible is startling, because you haven't heard it until recently, and you wonder, why haven't I heard this from the beginning? But deep students of the Bible have known it a long time. During the centuries when other great empires were dominant, general knowledge of the Israel identity would have been premature, for it would have aroused the jealousy and hatred of these other empires before we were strong enough to deal with them. But since we have come to national maturity, the knowledge has been available to all those who cared to learn the truth. There have been a number of books on this subject, such as The Lost Ten Tribes by Reverend Dr. Joseph Wild, published in 1883. The Fullness of the Nations by Aldersmith of London, published in 1889. Lost Israel Found by Edward Hine, published in England in the 1870s. And the many brilliant books written by Professor Totten of Yale University and published in the 1880s and 1890s. But I want to tell you of a lecture given before the United States Congress in 1857 by the Reverend F.E. Pitts of Nashville, Tennessee, in which he identified the United States as the land of regathered Israel and the scene of much of the final war, the so-called Battle of Armageddon, as pictured in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. Reverend Pitts pointed out that the land of the restored Israel was to be located between two seas. The East Sea was to be on its east side, while the Great Sea would be on the west side. That's Ezekiel 47, verses 18 to 20. Now, this could not be Palestine because there is no sea marking its east border. While not only do we have seas on the east and the west, but the Great Sea, the Pacific, is on the west. Also, Israel would then be in a land which had been always waste, that is, unused, uncultivated, which was never true of Palestine, but was true of our land until we settled it and began to cultivate it. That's Ezekiel 38, verse 8. The land of Israel, to be attacked by Russia, was to be inhabited by a population gathered out of many people and brought forth out of the nations. Again, Ezekiel 38, verse 8. And Isaiah 43, verses 5 and 6 says, I will bring thy seed from the east and gather thee from the west. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back, and bring my sons from far, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Also, Isaiah 60, verse 10 and 61, verse 5 points out that immigrants of non-Israel people would furnish our labor forces. Strangers shall stand and feed your flocks, and the sons of the alien shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. The sons of strangers shall build up thy walls. These immigrants would be allowed to own and inherit land. See Ezekiel 47, verses 22 and 23. This is a picture of the United States, but never of Palestine. It was to be a land of unwalled villages, them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. Now the prophet Ezekiel had never seen a city without walls and a barred gate, but our cities here have never had walls or gates. Today, most of the Jewish towns in Palestine have belts of barbed wire and explosive mines around them. This land of Israel in the last days was to be one which had greatly expanded in size. The 49th chapter of Isaiah tells us, Lift up thine eyes round about, and behold, all these gather themselves together and come to thee. For thy waste and thy desolate places, and the land of thy destruction, shall even now be too narrow by reason of the inhabitants, and they that swallowed thee up shall be far away. The children which thou shalt have, after thou hast lost the other, shall say again in thine ears, The place is too narrow for me. Give place to me that I may dwell. That is, we were outgrowing the old Palestinian land, even in Isaiah's day. But in the day to which he looked forward, we should be in another land, and they that swallowed us up shall be far away. That is, we would be far away from the Assyrian Empire, which had swallowed us up in Isaiah's day. But after we had lost our old land, the children we should have after that would say of the new land, It is too narrow for us. Give us more room as a place to dwell. In Reverend Pitt's time, we had already expanded from our original 13 colonies. We had added Texas and the great Mississippi Valley area of the Louisiana Purchase. We had annexed the great Southwest area from Mexico. We had gained California and the Pacific Coast. Nothing like this could be said of Palestine, either in ancient times, in 1857, or now. Again, Reverend Pitt saw that the Bible said that we would be in a land remarkable for the number of its majestic rivers. Isaiah 33, verse 21, saying, There the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall be no galley with oars. Now even the River Jordan is only a tiny river, and nothing else in Palestine is more than a mere rivulet. But here there are thousands of miles of great majestic rivers. And the Hebrew word translated galley actually means a government revenue clipper sent out by a superior kingdom to collect tariffs and taxes from a tributary people. There would be none of these here. In fact, our Boston Tea Party made sure of that. Again, our home in these days would be occupied by a peaceful people and all of one language. Reverend Pitts quoted Isaiah 33, verse 19. Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech than thou canst perceive, of a stammering tongue that thou canst not understand. Even though we have received great numbers of immigrants from Germany, Italy, France, as well as Scandinavia and the British Empire, one language prevailed over all the country. Also, the Bible prophesied that in our beginning we should be a nation of 13 colonies. Ezekiel 47, verse 13 says that ye shall inherit the land according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions. Starting with 12 tribes, but giving one of them two portions, makes 13 portions into which the land would be divided, and we did have the 13 original colonies. Likewise, Reverend Pitts noted that the Bible pointed out that in these latter days, we, the people of Israel, would be a republic. We will choose for ourselves a president. For Hosea 1, verse 11 says, Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head. We should not be like the monarchies of Europe, where the hereditary noble class intermarried, and by marriage, princes, dukes, and barons could govern other lands than their own. Here, only from among our own people could the governors, senators, and congressmen be chosen. Jeremiah 30, verse 21 points out, Their nobles shall be of themselves, and their governor shall proceed from the midst of them. And Isaiah 1, verse 26 says, I will restore thy judges as at the first, and thy counselors as at the beginning. When Israel was governed by her judges, she had no king but God. So God promised to restore this condition, and we find this to be true. Besides this and other prophecies identifying the United States as the peaceful people who would suffer the attack in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, Reverend Pitts also pointed out that the wicked attacker could not be anyone but Russia. Ezekiel says that this is Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, that is the ruler of Moscow, the capital of Western or European Russia, and Tobolsk, the capital of Eastern or Siberian Russia. Also, that old maps over many centuries have identified what is now Russia as being the lands of Gog, Meshech, and Tubal. The prophecies also point out that that giant nation will have allies or satellites taking in much of Europe, nearly all of Asia, and much of Africa, as Reverend Pitt stated. Now, that wasn't bad for 107 years ago, was it? He also saw that while Russia would invade Palestine as a minor part of her attack, her major effort would be in the invasion of the United States, with the attack reaching its climax and its catastrophic failure in the Mississippi Valley, which Ezekiel calls the Valley of the Passengers, on the east of the sea. There is nothing in Palestine that could correspond to this, but the Mississippi Valley both answers the description and is also the logical place for the attack, the great industrial heartland of our nation, the very place which Russia would naturally seek to knock out of production. So if you have thought that the recognition of the Anglo-Saxon nations, and especially the United States, as being God's people Israel, is just some sudden new idea, you are mistaken. The proof has been there in the Bible all the time. Of course, even 200 years ago, it would have been very hard to see, for we had not yet grown into the condition the prophets described. But, as you see, good Bible students could see this truth over a century ago, and once again prove that God's Word is always true. Whenever the people lose the quality of patriotism, their nation soon perishes, unless they have the pride and the courage to defend the nation which has brought them the civilization they enjoy. They cannot long retain that civilization, but they become the slaves of some more virile people. This is only justice, because liberty is only for those who deserve it. A nation's flag is a symbol of all that the nation itself stands for in the minds and hearts of its people. In times of greatest danger, they rally around the flag as a center of resistance to all perils, a living focus of the nation's unity. In our present period of increasing dangers from both within and without our nation, it would be well to restudy our own flag, symbol of all our greatness. Today, Mrs. Bertrand Comperet will speak on the subject, The Story of Our Flag. Mrs. Comperet.
From the beginning of civilization, flags have been used to symbolize the principles for which nations stand. Many different flags have floated over the territory now included in the United States. The original Union Jack was here, too. It was the Red Cross of St. George, and with it was subjoined the white diagonal cross of St. Andrew in a field of blue. It had come into being in 1606, following the Union of England and Scotland 3 years earlier. It was not the present Union Jack of Great Britain, for the red diagonal cross on the white ground, for Ireland, was not added until later. Why the diagonal crosses? Genesis, the 48th chapter, gives us the answer. When Jacob blessed the two sons of Joseph, he crossed his hands, putting his right hand on the head of Ephraim and his left on the head of Manasseh, saying that Manasseh would become a great people and Ephraim a multitude of nations. And so today we have the United States and the British Commonwealth of Nations, descendants of the tribe of Joseph, to whom was given the birthright. The first flag of the United Colonists, and the immediate predecessor of the Stars and Stripes, was the Grand Union flag, sometimes called the First Navy Ensign or the Cambridge flag. It was hoisted by order of General Washington on Prospect Hill in what is now Somerville, Massachusetts, on January 1, 1776. It had the Union Jack in the canton and red and white stripes. It was a peculiar flag, the stripes standing for the union of the colonies and their revolt against some other country, and the crosses indicating an allegiance to her not yet wholly broken. When reported in England, it was alluded to as the 13 rebellious stripes. This flag was never formalized by Congress, but was in use until nearly a year after the Declaration of Independence, until it was superseded by the Stars and Stripes. The authentic history of our flag began on June 14, 1777, when the American Congress adopted the following resolution: resolved that the flag of the 13 United States be 13 stripes, alternate red and white, that the Union be 13 stars, white in a blue field, representing a new constellation. It was George Washington who described it in these words: "We take the stars from heaven, the red from our mother country, separating it by white stripes, thus showing that we have separated from her, and the white stripes shall go down to posterity, representing liberty." When Vermont and Kentucky came into the Union on June 1, 1792, Congress soon passed an act increasing the stars and stripes on our national banner from 13 to 15. This was our national banner for 23 years. It was the flag which inspired Francis Scott Key to write the Star Spangled Banner. Then Tennessee came into the Union, and Ohio, then Louisiana and Indiana, but no provision had been made for their representation on the flag. Peter H. Wendover, a congressman from New York City, urged a change in form which would show their membership in the Sisterhood of States, and he was made chairman of a committee which made a recommendation from which I am quoting. In viewing this subject, there appears to be a happy coincidence of circumstances in having adopted the symbols in this flag, and a peculiar fitness of things in making the proposed alterations. In the part designed at a distance to characterize our country, and which ought, for the information of other nations, to appear conspicuous and remain permanent, you present the number of states that burst the bonds of oppression and achieved our independence. While in the part intended for the nearer or home view, you see a representation of our happy union as it now exists, the space sufficient to embrace the symbols of those who may hereinafter join our banner. After much debate, Congress passed the bill calling for these alterations. It was signed by President Monroe on the 4th of April, 1888. The law reads as follows: "Be it enacted that from and after the 4th of July next, the flag of the United States be 13 horizontal stripes, alternating red and white, that the Union have 20 stars, white in a blue field. Be it further enacted that on the admission of every new state into the Union, one star be added to the Union of the flag, and that such addition shall take effect on the 4th of July next succeeding such admission. Thus, on July 4th, 1818, the flag with 20 stars and 13 stripes appeared, and then came the addition of star after star for state after state, until on July 4th, 1960, after the admission of Alaska and Hawaii, the star is numbered 50. No star has ever been removed." Henry Ward Beecher said, "A thoughtful mind, when it sees a nation's flag, sees not the flag, but the nation itself. And whatever may be the symbols, its insignia, he reads chiefly in the flag the government, the principles, the truths, the history that belong to the nation that set it forth. The American symbol has been the symbol of liberty, and men rejoiced in it." Let us trace our nation and our flag from their biblical origin. As we have said so many times on this program, we are an Israel nation, and God commanded Israel to set up standards or banners or flags, one for each tribe. Numbers 1:52 says, "And the children of Israel shall pitch their tents, every man by his own standard, throughout their hosts." They are referred to 21 times in Numbers, Isaiah, and Jeremiah. In Psalm 20, the fifth verse says, "In the name of our God, we will set up our banners. This we have done." Note the colors of our flag. When the Lord gave Moses the Ten Commandments, they were deposited in the Ark of the Covenant within the tabernacle, whose curtains were red, white, blue, and purple. So being Israel, it isn't strange that we have chosen the Israel colors of old. As for the scriptural significance of these colors, red is the color of blood and signifies justice or judgment, reminding us of the life laid down by the Son of God. White signifies purity or holiness. Blue, the color of the sky, signifies loyalty and consecration. Numbers 15:38 tells us, "Speak unto the children of Israel and bid them that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a riband of blue, that ye may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them." Why stars in our flag? When you turn to the Bible, you will find that our American forefathers were using Israel symbols there too. Jacob himself recognized stars as the sign of the Israel family. In Genesis 37, verses 9 and 10, it says, "And Joseph dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down themselves to thee in the earth?" The only object ever permitted to rest upon our national flag is the Holy Bible, just as the church pennant is the only banner permitted to fly above it in the United States Navy. These are clear national recognitions of the Word of God as the overruling spiritual force. We salute the flag. There are some who do not care to pay their respects to the flag of the United States of America. They regard saluting the flag as a sign of worship, but it isn't that. It is a sign of respect for the government for which the flag stands. God organized a government at Mount Sinai, and to that government he gave authority to rule, instructing each tribe to encamp by its own standard, the emblem of its authority, and to which respect was to be shown. From that biblical injunction comes the Israel respect for the flag and the government it represents, as exemplified in our oath of allegiance when we salute the flag. "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." The stars and stripes symbolize these thoughts. Long may our land be bright with freedom's holy light. Protect us by thy might, great God our King.
Thank you, Mrs. Comperay. I am sure that we can all be both better Americans and better Christians with the knowledge that our American flag proclaims not only our national independence, but also our Israel origin and identity. One of the eternal truths is that we should pledge our loyalty and service for God and country, for they are one and inseparable. Because we are the true children of God, the real Israel of the Bible, God has built us into the great nation which he promised to our ancestor Abraham. We are that great nation only because we are truly God's people. And any time we cease to remember and conduct ourselves as God's people, we will cease to be a great nation. Our ancestors had to learn that bitter lesson several times. Pray that we may not bring it on ourselves in too severe a form. Yes, I know that no human being on this earth is perfect, including ourselves, but that does not change the fact that we are still the children of God, and even the occasional need to punish us, to teach us the penalties of disobedience, does not diminish God's love for his own sons and daughters. Neither does it lead him to break his promises to us.